president. You can't be negative. You got to be. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? This is the United States of America. If you want to talk about decorum and tone, your real concern should be the way in which Trump's lack of decorum completely debased the office of the presidency for 4 years. Folks are worried I'm mean to Trump, yet they weren't worried about Trump mimicking a disabled reporter and the thousands of things that he did. Give me a break, guys. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. It's really a good one.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Today's bonus show, we're actually not going to make money on, but we are going to discuss. It turns out that that billionaire, Harlan Crow, Clarence Thomas's friend, paid school tuition for some kid that isn't Clarence Thomas's son, but that Clarence Thomas sort of was like fathering. It's yet another really weird story involving Clarence Thomas. Number two, Republicans are furious that Joe Biden is sending troops to the border, even though it's what they wanted. Now they're mad that it's happening. Okay. And we will discuss the new Utah law that has now gone into effect, requiring all sorts of verification to browse pornography websites. It's wacky what is going on socially in Utah. It's one of the most backward states socially in the country. And we're going to talk about that and much, much more. All of those stories on today's bonus show, which you can access by signing up at joinpacman.com. Full price is a great deal, but you can use the coupon code 24 starts now. 24 starts now. All one word, no spaces, uppercase, lowercase, doesn't matter. 24 starts now. We'll save you about 50% off of the cost of a membership. We'll see you then. Well, I woke up this morning and I said to myself, sir, we should really do a show today. There's a lot going on. And so here we are. That's the context in which today's program is being produced. One programming note, dozens of people writing to me breathlessly. You could tell even though it was written text that people were breathless, saying, David, when is your Lex Fridman appearance coming out? I don't know the answer, but Lex said it would be 3 or 4 days from when we filmed it earlier this week. So I would guess by the end of this week, but I don't know and I don't have any control over it. But I'm as eager to take a look at it as some of the other folks in the audience are. So we'll know about that very, very soon. All right, listen, I've been waiting for this and it is now happening. Republicans, right wingers, MAGA types, Steven Crowder and others are now coming after what we call no-fault divorce, which essentially translates to they want to force women to have to stay married unless they can give what some consider an acceptable reason for why they should be allowed to get divorced. What on earth am I talking about? Let's backtrack and let's set it up. I had no plan to talk about right-wing content creator Steven Crowder's divorce on the podcast. There's really just no reason to talk about it. I don't know. There's nothing particularly newsworthy about it, except when I watched his brief explanation of the personal trouble that he's having, and including this very contentious divorce, he seemed to sort of bemoan the fact that his wife can just say, hey, I want a divorce, and it's called no-fault divorce. You don't have to prove that someone cheated or whatever. To justify the divorce, you're just allowed to say, I don't want to be in this marriage anymore. And in the video that Steven Crowder put out about this, he seemed to be sort of suggesting that that's a problem, that that's not OK. His wife maybe should be forced to stay married to him. And he's not the only one who feels this way. Let's take a listen. This is the video from, I guess now it's been about a week since this news broke, to the extent that it's news.
I have been living with a proverbial boot on my neck for going on years now. Since 2021, I've been living through what has increasingly been a horrendous divorce. Now, let me say on the outset, to be clear, there is no infidelity, any kind of physical abuse at all on either side. And no, this was not my choice. my then wife decided that she didn't want to be married anymore. And in the state of Texas, that is completely permitted.
It's permitted. It's allowed. As crazy as it is, you're just allowed to say, I don't want to be married anymore.
Opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Former President Donald Trump has been ordered to pay $5 million to E. Jean Carroll after a jury found him liable for sexually abusing and defaming her. We'll speak to Jessica Leeds, who testified during the trial about how Trump sexually assaulted her during a flight in the 1970s.
He was trying to kiss me. His hands were on my breasts. He was, we were kind of wrestling, but I didn't say anything. He didn't say anything, so it was like this kind of kabuki theater in the silence.
Then, as Title 42, the Trump-era pandemic policy blocking asylum seekers, ends Thursday, President Biden plans stronger enforcement measures on the border.
I spent close to an hour with the Mexican president today. We're doing all we can. It's going to be chaotic for a while.
We'll speak to the Salvadoran poet and writer Javier Zamora, author of the best-selling memoir Solito. As a 9-year-old boy, he traveled alone 4,000 miles to reach the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A New York jury unanimously found former President Donald Trump liable for the sexual abuse and defamation of writer E. Jean Carroll, awarding her $5 million in damages. The jury, however, rejected a rape charge. During the trial, Carroll recounted her sexual assault by Trump in the dressing room of Bergdorf Goodman in the 1990s. Since it was a civil trial, Trump was not convicted of a crime and does not face prison time. Trump's lawyer said he would appeal, while the ex-president called the verdict a disgrace and said, I have absolutely no idea who this woman is. In a statement, E. Jean Carroll said, quote, today the world finally knows the truth. This victory is not just for me, but for every woman who has suffered because she was not believed. We'll have more on this story after headlines and speak with one of the witnesses in the trial, Jessica Leeds, about her experience of Donald Trump sitting down on a plane and sexually assaulting her. CBS News is reporting the Biden administration is expected to publish today new procedures for quickly deporting migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border ahead of the lifting of the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy Thursday. President Biden said he expects the situation at the southern border to become chaotic. The new rule would require the majority of asylum seekers to request refugee status in another country like Mexico before reaching the U.S. Deported migrants will be barred from re-entering the U.S. for 5 years. Earlier this week, 233 groups, including the ACLU, Amnesty International USA, Detention Watch Network, and Raices, sent an open letter to President Biden demanding he follow through on his commitment to never detain migrant families, end for-profit immigration jails, and to allow people to live with dignity in their communities while their cases are being resolved in court instead of being locked up and surveilled. The groups write, quote, detention places people in conditions known to cause mental and physical harm and endanger their lives. Detention is not a deterrent to migrants who have no choice but to flee dangerous or violent conditions in search of a better life, they wrote. Meanwhile, immigrant justice groups in Texas held protests in Austin Tuesday to demand lawmakers reject HB 20 and HB 7. Which would deputize vigilantes to carry out immigration enforcement in Texas and create a parallel court system to try migrants and smugglers picked up by state-run patrols. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy remain at a stalemate over debt ceiling negotiations after meeting Tuesday for the first time in 3 months. The two agreed to meet again as the U.S. inches closer to a possible default as early as June 1st. McCarthy has demanded spending cuts before agreeing to raise the debt limit, which Biden has refused to consider as Democrats slam Republicans of economic hostage taking. Biden spoke after Tuesday's meeting.
Everyone in the meeting understood the risk of default. Our economy would fall into a significant recession. It would devastate retirement accounts, increase borrowing costs. According to Moody's, nearly 8 million Americans would lose their jobs, and our international reputation would be damaged in the extreme.
Calls are mounting for President Biden to invoke the 14th Amendment, which would allow him to continue issuing debt bypassing Congress. Biden has said he has not taken that option off the table. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot dead two Palestinians during a raid in the town of Kabatia. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip continued for a second day, with at least one Palestinian killed today after the air raids killed at least 15 Palestinians and wounded 22 others Tuesday, according to officials. This is a shop owner in Gaza.
It's a hard situation, to be honest. We face fear. We are staying tuned. We don't know what will happen. The situation is, everyone doesn't know what will happen, whether we are going to have a war or ceasefire.
In Ukraine, French journalist Armand Soldin was killed in a rocket attack Tuesday in Khasiv Yar, near the war-torn eastern city of Bakhmut. The 32-year-old journalist worked for the AFP news agency. The Committee to Protect Journalists says he's the 15th reporter to be killed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year. In more news about the war, the head of the Russian mercenary Wagner Group said President Putin's troops have started to abandon their positions in Bakhmut. This comes as Britain's poised to designate Wagner as a terrorist group. France's National Assembly approved a similar measure Tuesday and urged the European Union to follow suit. In Pakistan, nearly 1,000 people have been arrested as protests broke out following the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan Tuesday. His supporters gathered today as Khan made another appearance in Islamabad court, where he was indicted for selling state gifts during his premiership between 2018 and 2022. A court yesterday ruled his arrest was lawful as his legal team continued to fight the charges. Former UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn called Khan's arrest a dark day for democracy. Authorities have shut down social media sites while a judge is set to rule on a request for permission to detain Khan for at least 14 days. This is one of Khan's supporters.
What they have done, is this not hooliganism? Is this not terrorism? Imran Khan had gone to appear before court. Now, where is Supreme Court? Where is High Court? Where are the judges?
In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his main rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, have been holding massive rallies ahead of crucial elections this Sunday that could see the end of Erdogan's rule after more than 20 years in power. President Erdogan announced Tuesday his government's raising its workers' salaries by 45% in a bid to counter voter concerns over Turkey's ailing economy amid soaring inflation. Erdogan also is facing continued backlash over his response to the catastrophic February earthquake and damning reports of lax building regulations and neglecting warnings about the safety of structures.
Let's talk the truth here now. My whole family is gone. They are all deceased. Why wouldn't I be angry against the government? No machinery came to help. Nothing did.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is backed by a multi-party alliance, has vowed to pursue closer ties with NATO and the European Union, reinforce democratic institutions like independent courts and a free press. He also said he would reverse Erdogan's dissolution of the position of prime minister in the 2017 constitutional referendum.
We are not going to leave the fate of the Turkish Republic in the hand of one person, and no one will accept the words of just one person.
Conservative President Erdogan has also appealed to his religious base, accusing his opponent of being pro-LGBT at an Istanbul rally Sunday. Back in the United States, embattled Republican Congressmember George Santos is expected to appear in a New York court today after federal prosecutors file criminal charges against him. Details of the charges are not yet known, but the New York congressman has been under investigation for his many lies around his campaign financing, biography, education, and work history. Santos has defied numerous calls to resign. Separately, a hearing in Brazil is scheduled for Thursday over charges Santos committed check fraud. In California, a state reparations task force approved recommendations on compensating and apologizing to black residents for generations of discrimination and violence from slavery to the present day. Congressmember and U.S. Senate candidate Barbara Lee, who's helping lead a congressional push for reparations, spoke at the meeting Saturday in Oakland, which she represents in the U.S. House.
Reparations are not a luxury for our people, but a human right long overdue for millions of Americans. Millions of Americans. A promise of 40 acres and a mule made to formerly enslaved people over 150 years ago has yet to be filled. And it's critical that the promise be made that was made to our ancestors many years ago is kept. And the process of truth-telling and racial healing, that's got to be carried out also. The atrocities committed against Black Americans are undeniable. And reparations are a tangible route to acknowledging and making amends.
If the measure is approved by California's legislature and Governor Gavin Newsom, it'll provide monetary compensation to black residents for discriminatory policies, including mass incarceration, policing, housing discrimination, health care inequalities, and environmental racism. In labor news, service employees, international union workers at the union's headquarters in Washington, D.C., have authorized a strike as they continue contract negotiations for better wages and protections. Many walked off the job Tuesday as employees accused the SEIU president, Mary Kay Henry, and the secretary-treasurer of supporting union-busting tactics and refusing to negotiate in good faith. Paramount Global is laying off a quarter of its staff and shutting down MTV News. Head of Paramount Media Networks Chris McCarthy made the announcement to employees in an emailed memo. Paramount's also the parent company of CBS, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, and Showtime. The latest media layoffs come after massive job cuts at Vice News, BuzzFeed is closing, and other companies. And David Miranda, Brazilian journalist and the first LGBTQ member of the Rio de Janeiro City Council, has died at the age of 37. The news was announced by his husband, journalist Glenn Greenwald, on Tuesday. David Miranda had spent 9 months in intensive care after being hospitalized last August for a severe gastrointestinal infection. Tributes to Miranda, who also served in Brazil's Congress, poured in following the news. The Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, noted his extraordinary trajectory. Miranda, born in a favela and orphaned at the age of five, continued to fight for Brazil's poor and the LGBTQ community, which came under renewed attack during the presidency of Jair Bolsonaro. NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden also paid tribute to Miranda, celebrating his courage and righteousness and helping bring his leaked documents to light in 2013. Miranda was notably detained for 9 hours at London's Heathrow Airport, but refused to cooperate with authorities. Snowden wrote, "It was that courage that set him free," unquote. David Miranda is survived by his husband and their two children. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Donald Trump has been found guilty of sexually abusing and defaming E. Jean Carroll. The jury has awarded her $5 million. We'll speak to a journalist as well as Jessica Leeds. She's one of the people who testified in Carroll's trial about her own sexual assault by Donald Trump. Stay with us.
Nobody said it would be easy. Nobody said that it would all be fine. But to get where we're going, brother, gotta hold the line. It ain't a matter of if, it's just a matter of time. To get where we're going, sister, gotta hold the line. Hold the line, gotta hold the line. Hold the line. Hold the line. Hold the line.
gotta stay steadfast and tread lightly, 'cause they're looking for a reason to knock you down. But you can't act too politely. In the trenches, you gotta get loud. You gotta stay steadfast and tread lightly, 'cause they're looking for a reason to knock
Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine singing Hold the Line in a video he posted in solidarity with Oakland teachers who are on strike. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Donald Trump has been ordered to pay $5 million to writer E. Jean Carroll after a jury found him liable for sexually abusing and defaming her. The jury in the civil trial reached its verdict after just 3 hours of deliberations. The jury, however, did not find that Trump raped Carroll. In a statement, E. Jean Carroll said, "I filed this lawsuit against Donald Trump to clear my name and to get my life back. Today, the world finally knows the truth. This victory is not just for me, but for every woman who has suffered because she was not believed," she said. During the trial, E. Jean Carroll recounted how Trump sexually assaulted her in the 90s inside the dressing room of the Bergdorf Goodman department store, located a block from Trump Tower. During the trial, Trump's defense team did not call any witnesses, and Trump rejected his chance to testify during the trial. On Tuesday, Trump, who's running for president again, posted a number of messages and videos on his social media platform blasting the verdict.
"We'll be appealing this decision. It's a disgrace. I don't even know who this woman is. I have no idea who she is, where she came from. This is another scam. It's a political witch hunt."
In a video deposition recently made public, Donald Trump claimed E. Jean Carroll was, quote, "not my type." But during questioning in the tape deposition, Trump mistook E. Jean Carroll for his ex-wife, Marla Maples.
"You say Marla's in this photo?"
"That's Marla, yeah. That's my wife."
"Which woman are you pointing to?"
"No.
That's
here.
Carol.
Oh, is that?
The person you just pointed to was E. Jean Carroll."
"Who is that? Who is this?"
"Point, your wife." "And the person, the woman on the right, is your then-wife, Ivana?"
"I don't know. This was the picture. I assume that's John Johnson. Is that
Carol?
Because it's very blurry."
In a moment, we'll be joined by Jessica Leeds, who testified during the trial about how Trump sexually assaulted her during a flight in the 1970s. But we begin with Moira Donegan in San Francisco, an opinion columnist covering gender and politics for The Guardian, also a writer in residence at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. Moira, thanks so much for joining us. Can you first respond to the verdict, to a unanimous jury finding Donald Trump liable for sexually assaulting and defaming E. Jean Carroll?
Well, thank you for having me, Amy. And I think something that to remember about this verdict is that it was unusually fast. That suggests that this wasn't very close. You know, usually in even a civil trial like this, a jury will be out in deliberations for much longer. They came back yesterday in just under 3 hours, which suggests that, you know, there wasn't a lot of doubt in the jurors' minds about who was telling the truth here. I think this is a really significant moment for American women and specifically for the Me Too movement. You know, Donald Trump was sort of the figure whose boorishness, his shamelessness, his, you know, long standing impunity for sexual assault really did inspire this rage at the, you know, ongoing and very pervasive sexual abuse of women, mostly by men. And his lack of accountability for many years had been a motivator and an insult. You know, it was insulting, I think, to the citizenship of American women to have somebody who had been so contemptuous of their dignity in a position of great power. So that a court of law has now held him accountable, held him liable, is, I think, a really significant moment.
Can you talk about the law that enabled E. Jean Carroll decades later to bring this lawsuit against Donald Trump here in New York City?
Yeah. So, you know, the law under which this lawsuit was filed is something called the New York Adult Survivors Act, which was a long time coming. It is a law that extended the statute of limitations or created a one-year, they call it a look-back window, that began on Thanksgiving, during which, you know, survivors of sexual abuse who have sort of gone past the statute of limitations, whose assaults occurred too long ago to file civil suits, have this opportunity over the course of a year to, you know, look back, to bring back their claims and to file civil, not criminal, but civil suits that would have otherwise been prohibited by the statute of limitations. E. Jean Carroll lobbied for this law, and her attorneys filed the lawsuit just within hours of it having gone into effect.
And so people can actually still file suits, right? That window is still open till, what is it, November?
Yes, there's 6 more months. If there's any survivors in New York who have, you know, assaults, who have claims that have happened beyond the statute of limitations, they still have that opportunity to file civil claims and to try and get some justice.
During the trial, the jury was shown the infamous Access Hollywood video, in which Trump brags about grabbing women's genitals without asking permission.
I gotta use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy. I can do anything.
You can do anything, Trump said in that videotape. Well, during a videotape deposition seen by the jury, Trump defended his comments in the Access Hollywood tape.
And this has become very famous. In this video, I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab them by the p-. You can do anything. That's what you said, correct?
Well, historically, that's true with stars.
It's true with stars that they can grab women by the p-.
Well, that's what it's, if you look over the last million years, I guess that's been largely true. Not always, but largely true. Unfortunately or fortunately.
And you consider yourself to be a star?
I think you can say that, yeah.
That was Donald Trump in the videotape deposition that was shown in court. And yet he refused to be there live to testify, which is extremely significant, Moira. If you can talk about this. I mean, he was golfing in Ireland at his golf course and said that he would be challenging E. Jean Carroll, whoever she is, and the judge in court. And when the judge took him up on the offer and said that this was, what, last Thursday, that he'd have until Sunday, even though his lawyer had rested the case, to say whether he would come into court. He didn't. The significance of this, Moira. So the only thing the jury saw were these damning clips from his deposition.
It's a really damning, it's a really remarkable exchange. You know, that phrase, fortunately or unfortunately, really, I think, bolstered Carroll's claim that the Access Hollywood tape amounts to not, as Donald Trump had characterized it, mere, you know, quote unquote locker room talk, but really a confession, right? He's reaffirming not only his misogynist attitudes, but really a true lack of remorse and lack of a moral objection to sexual assault. You know, Donald Trump performed so badly in that deposition, and he incriminated himself further in this kind of remarkable way, as you noted. And I think that, you know, it might not have been entirely unwise for him from a legal standpoint to avoid coming to the trial. I think, you know, he would not probably have performed very well on cross. He doesn't have a lot of self-control. He's very indignant. He's very impulsive. And, you know, I don't think he would have helped his own case. That said, I think it did also make a impression on the jury, you know, how much disregard for the proceedings, disinterest in mounting a real defense, sort of seemingly, you know, casual irreverence for the seriousness of what was being alleged in this civil court. You know, that I don't think that helped him either. I think, you know, all that the jurors really heard was a ton of corroboration from E. Jean Carroll, a ton of, you know, confessions and reaffirmations of his, you know, character and habits from the long record of Donald Trump, and particularly that excess Hollywood tape, which was played many times in court. But they didn't really hear much of a defense from Trump's side. And that, I think, you know, really made a big impression.
I want to bring into this discussion Jessica Leeds, who testified during the trial. She told jurors about how Trump groped her during a flight on a plane in the 1970s. In 2018, Jessica Leeds came to our Democracy Now! Studio here in New York and described what happened when she sat next to Trump in first class on the flight.
Dinner was served, and it was after dinner when truly, all of a sudden, without a word, without a "by you leave" or about any kind of social conversation, he started groping me.
What does that mean? What did he do?
His hands were—he was trying to kiss me. His hands were on my breast. He was—we were kind of wrestling, but I didn't say anything. He didn't say anything, so it was like this kind of kabuki theater in the silence. I remember thinking, why doesn't the guy across the aisle say something? Why doesn't the stewardess come back? And it seemed to go on forever, but of course it didn't.
He put his hand up your skirt?
Yes. He started putting his hand up my skirt. And that's when I, with effort, managed to wiggle my way out, grab my purse, and I went to the back of the airplane. And I sat there until the plane landed and was completely clear because I didn't want to run into him.
That was Jessica Leeds speaking on Democracy Now! In 2018. Again, she testified in E. Jean Carroll, the defamation and battery trial. She is joining us now from Asheville, North Carolina. Jessica Leeds, thanks so much for rejoining us on Democracy Now! Can I first get your response to President Trump being found guilty of sexual assault against E. Jean Carroll?
I'm really pleased. I'm pleased for E. Jean. I'm pleased for what it says. I am sorry that the jury couldn't come up with a rape charge, but that's kind of understandable. Baby steps here. Baby steps.
You know, I was curious. She was able to file this suit because of this law that had opened up in New York that still has 6 months where people can sue someone who assaulted them years ago. Are you weighing suing Donald Trump as well?
No, I have kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. I would not want to put them through that.
But which is quite a testimonial to E. Jean Carroll, Jessica. What do you make of what E. Jean Carroll did, going through this again decades later? And talk about what made you decide to testify. There are dozens of women who've accused Donald Trump of sexual assault. You were one of two women who testified in E. Jean Carroll's trial.
Well, I think they wanted to use people who could show a pattern of behavior, especially over the years. This is what I got from talking to the lawyers. E. Jean is a very strong, creative woman. And when she finally recognized the damage that had been done to her, it had taken a while. And for her to step up and do this takes a great deal of courage. But I think she got some good support. I think she had damn good lawyers, and I think it paid off. I think I mentioned one time in an interview that I thought that all of these women had basically the same story. So for him to totally reject us is just sort of ridiculous.
You know, it's interesting what Donald Trump said. He continually said now on social media and this video that he released, he said he does not know this woman. Now, interestingly, when E. Jean Carroll's lawyer in the deposition showed him a picture, he kept saying, she's not my type, she's not my type, showed him a picture and said, can you identify who this is? He identified the woman the lawyer was pointing to in a photograph standing next to him as his second wife, Marla Maples. But in fact, it was E. Jean Carroll. But when he says, I did not know her, I don't know her. In fact, so many of these women, including you, Jessica Leeds, he did not know when he attacked you. Is that correct?
That's correct. And not only that, at this point in his life, he has a selective memory. And most of these situations, most of this activity is just like second nature to him. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't register at all, which is horrifying because the psychological damage it does on people who are sexually abused is tremendous. But for him, he likes women. He thinks he likes women. He likes dominating women. And he likes... But the real gist of it right now is he can't see past the aging process. So he looks at E. Jean and she's a late 70s lady and he can't see what she looked like or see the beauty in her face right now. It's stupid, but that's part of our society's problems too.
And also this continually saying she's not my type. He's not my type to sexually abuse. I mean, as we all know, rape and sexual abuse has everything to do with power. And not to do with attraction. Jessica Leeds, when we interviewed you, I always remembered you talking about the effect afterwards. I mean, you weren't even sitting in first class. The flight attendants came to you sitting right in the back and said, you can sit up here. And that's how you ended up sitting next to this man, Donald Trump.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct.
You said you never wore a skirt again on a flight?
That's right. That's right. Well, and I'd have to say, what was it, a week ago, there was a report of a man putting his hand up the stewardess's skirt. To this day and age, I mean, this continues.
Jessica Leeds, do you hope that this will inspire other people to come forward, not only accusing Donald Trump, but especially, for example, this law in New York, though it doesn't have to be just this law, but the Adult Survivors Act that goes through the 1 year look back where a sexual assault survivor can file a case, this one time period of time. Do you hope people who have been victims of sexual assault and rape will come forward now?
The wheels of the justice system move so slowly. That's a tough call. I really don't know how useful that is to encourage people who have been sexually abused to take that route. I would just wish that in our society, we could address this issue, talk about it, do some research, and help the survivors. You might even look upon this as a form of, we send men off to war and come back and they've got PTSD. Well, how about women who've suffered sexual abuse getting some counseling and help and whatnot for that? That's what I think.
Jessica, I wanted to play for you Trump's attorney, Joseph Tacopina, standing on the steps of the courthouse yesterday after the verdict came down.
You know, we're in one sense gratified, and I know some people in this camp are very happy that, you know, the rape claim was rejected, but, you know, I'm not, and I am happy about that, certainly, but I'm not happy that he was found liable for anything whatsoever.
He wasn't fully committal on this, saying, well, at least Donald Trump wasn't found guilty of rape. So there were three choices in battery. One was rape, one was sexual assault, and the third was unwanted sexual touching. Your response to that point, though, interestingly, Donald Trump hasn't made it very much. Clearly, he understands the significance of this decision by a civil court coming down unanimous, six men, three women, finding him guilty of sexual assault as he runs for president again. But your response to that?
Well, the lawyer, who is very aggressive and could be described as a bulldog, is doing his best to represent Trump. I hope he gets paid. But, and how much this is going to affect Trump's core, who are unfortunately cult-like in their devotion, I don't know how much this will this will help. But if it helps E. Jean, and it brings the topic out for discussion and coverage, okay, I'm satisfied.
And final question: the issue of this being a civil trial. So, in fact, the difference between being found guilty and being found liable.
That's what I mean about going to the justice system. There are people who are going to equate the fact that he wasn't convicted, and they got confused over charges and whether who was who and who was defending and who was prosecuting. It got pretty confusing. So we need to go back to civics class. But I think this was a good outcome, and I'm very thankful.
And I'll just ask a last question. You came out before President Trump won election in 2016, as did well over a dozen women. Was it 20, more than 20 women?
Yes.
He was elected president. Now he has been found liable for sexually assaulting a woman in a department store dressing room. He's running for president again. Your thoughts?
Again, he has a core of people who will vote for him. The truest thing he ever said was he could stand at the corner of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and it would not lose any votes. That is so true. I just hope that the rest of the world can see through and know that we need somebody much, much better than this to manage the country.
Jessica Leeds, I want to thank you for being with us. She is one of two witnesses who testified in E. Jean Carroll's case about their own experience of Donald Trump sexually assaulting them. She told jurors about how she sat down on a plane next to him in a flight in the 1970s, and how he groped her. Moira Donegan, I also want to thank you, opinion columnist for The Guardian, writer in residence at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. We'll link to your pieces on this case. Coming up, we speak to the Salvadoran poet and writer, Javier Zamora, author of the best-selling memoir Solito, about his 4,000-mile journey without his family, from Salvador through Guatemala, Mexico, to the Sonoran Desert of Arizona as a 9-year-old. Stay with us.
Cup of Joe and a pioneer's tribe, but I'm gone.
I'm Gone by Sundance Songs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday at midnight, the United States will end the pandemic policy known as Title 42 that's been used by the Trump and Biden administrations to block nearly 3 million asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Some reports indicate there are as many as 150,000 migrants on the Mexican side of the border who hope to apply for relief as soon as possible after the policy is lifted. This is a Colombian migrant who joined others at the border fence in the Mexican city of Tijuana Tuesday.
I'm like in limbo. Let's see what happens. I hope to be able to pass to the United States because I have a son there. He's 18 years old, and I want to be with him.
This week, authorities in El Paso and other U.S. border cities have carried out targeted operations against hundreds of migrants who already arrived and were sleeping on the streets outside overflowing shelters. President Biden said he spoke by phone Tuesday with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador about border security issues.
I spent close to an hour with the Mexican president today. We're doing all we can. The answer is it remains to be seen. We've gotten overwhelming cooperation from Mexico. We also are in the process of setting up offices in Colombia and other places where you can, or someone seeking asylum can go first. So, but it remains to be seen. It's going to be chaotic for a while.
CBS News reports the Biden administration plans to launch new procedures for quickly deporting migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border as soon as today. Most asylum seekers will be required to request refugee status in another country like Mexico before reaching the U.S. Deported migrants would be barred from reentering the U.S. for 5 years. This week, over 230 groups sent an open letter to President Biden demanding he follow through on his commitment not to detain migrant families and to end for-profit immigration jails, writing, quote, "Detention places people in conditions known to cause mental and physical harm and endanger their lives. Detention is not a deterrent to migrants who have no choice but to flee dangerous or violent conditions in search of a better life," they wrote. For more, we're joined by Javier Zamora, a Salvadoran poet and writer whose New York Times best-selling memoir, Solita, tells the story of his own odyssey to the United States as a 9-year-old boy from Salvador across Guatemala, Mexico, and eventually through the Sonoran Desert. He traveled unaccompanied by his family, by boat, by bus, and by foot. After a coyote abandoned his group in Oaxaca, Mexico, in Oaxaca, Javier made it to Arizona with help from other migrants. He's also the author of Unaccompanied, a collection of poems about his experience migrating to the United States as a child to reunite with his parents. Javier Zamora, welcome to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your own personal journey, which is so powerful and so important to understand, I'm wondering if you can respond to what's happening, to President Biden saying it'll be chaos at the border for a time, to the pandemic era Trump Title 42 policy being lifted tomorrow night at midnight, and what this means.
I think it's always been chaos, right? I don't think that this will fix anything. Things will get worse. Things are already really bad. And I just can't help to think of all the people waiting, all the people that will continue to wait, and all the people who are still fleeing for their lives from all over Latin America and the world. And I would just hope that this presidency and any future presidencies will treat immigrants like actual human beings.
So let's talk about that journey that so many have taken through so many countries by you telling your own story. Can you start by telling us about where you were born in El Salvador and how you ended up coming to the United States? Take us on that journey of your life.
Well, I was born in 1990 in the small fishing rural village of El Salvador called La Herradura. And, you know, I was born during wartime. And because of the Salvadoran Civil War that started in 1980 and in 1992, my dad fled in 1991. The war ended, but the war didn't end at the same time. So my mom left my country in 1995. I was left at the care.
I'm only interrupting for a moment, because before you take us on that journey, if you could expand more on when you said your father left. You're talking about a country where the U.S. backed the military in Salvador, well-known for killing thousands of Salvadorans. Can you give us a picture of what that U.S. policy meant? Because I think that is what is so absent from so many discussions as people now try to make their way to the United States.
You know, at one point, only Israel was getting more money than El Salvador in the 80s, and we're talking millions of dollars a day. And before the U.S. got involved, the left was winning. And what the left wanted was equality, women's rights, and education. And because of those asks, my dad was a leftist, and he was the head of a co-op. One of his older brothers was disappeared by the military in 1980, and the violence was everywhere. And because of those reasons and because of his ideological leanings, he had to flee in 1991. And same with my mom. You know, it is still difficult in my country in 2023 and also in this country being a woman. There's a lot of gender-based violence. And because of, you know, you were talking a lot about sexual assault, and that is everywhere. And that was a huge reason why my mom also fled the country.
And so you were, 1 year old?
I was 1 when my dad left, and I was 5 when my mother left.
Being raised then by your grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about them deciding for you to take this journey and how you traveled.
You know, the moment that my dad left, we would communicate via letters and phone calls. When my mom left, it was the same thing. And what they both told me was that they were going to come back. And we have to remember that in the brief period of time, El Salvador had peace. And that was, it lined up with my childhood. 1993 till 1999 was perhaps the most peaceful moment in my country's timeline. But in 1997, you know, people were beginning to get shot in my hometown, and my parents changed from "we're going to return to El Salvador" to "you're going to come be with us in the United States." And so from 7, 8, and 9, I knew that I wanted to be reunited with my parents. What kid doesn't want to be and wake up next to his parents? And so I didn't really understand how I was going to get here or how dangerous it was for me to travel the 4,000 miles that I did. But what I did know is that I loved my parents and I really, really, really wanted to be with them.
So you went with your grandfather from Salvador to Guatemala?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So my grandpa accompanied me all the way to a border town called Tecumuman, which is still a very major crossing hub. And from then on, he gave me over to the coyote, a smuggler, and I wasn't the only one with him. I was part of a larger group of 7 other immigrants, and he, the smuggler, was supposed to bring us to the United States in as little as 1 week from Guatemala. And of course, that doesn't happen.
And then your grandfather leaves, and talk about how you traveled on from there and the massive danger. I mean, you almost didn't make it to the United States. If you could then talk about going through to Mexico and what happened.
You know, I still don't know why my trip took the turns that it did. But the plan was for me to cross a river from Guatemala into Mexico. That was the original plan. But I have done some research, and already in 1999, the Mexican government was militarizing the southern border. And this is also continuing to happen now. And so because of that militarization, the Coyote thought that it would be easier for us to cross into Mexico if we took a 22-hour boat ride from Guatemala to bypass Chiapas and land in Oaxaca. And that is what we did. But when we were supposed to get on the boats, there were news that three boats had capsized and immigrants died. And this is still happening in the southern borders and people are trying to get over here. So that was my fiasco and like number one when I was so close to death. As a 9-year-old, I didn't really understand it as such. What I understood was that I couldn't swim and that I was scared of sharks and I was scared of the night. So those were my fears. In reality, I was very close to death on that boat. And that was my first day in Mexico. And when we land, we also face a checkpoint, which still happen daily all over Mexican states against Central Americans and other immigrants. And because of those checkpoints in 1999, we were dragged out and robbed by the Mexican military. And from then on, it was weeks until we meaning the group of six other immigrants, until we figured out how to make it to the Sonoran Desert and the U.S.-Mexico border.
So talk about crossing the border and what it meant to be in the Sonoran Desert. I mean, you have obviously a very different experience right now living in Tucson, Arizona. But what it meant to cross and then to be there, to survive in the hot, parched desert.
You know, similar to the boat, as a kid, my 9-year-old brain didn't, I think subconsciously I knew how close to danger I was. But in the front head of my brain, I was like, oh, look at this weird plant called a cactus. And I'm really thirsty. I don't have food. But if I keep on walking, my parents are at that finish line. So that's how I understood this as a 9-year-old. All the adults around me, by that point that we made it to the U.S.-Mexico border, it wasn't only the six. There were immigrants from Ecuador. There were immigrants from Cuba. There were immigrants even from Brazil at that time who we all joined together in a group, I want to say 50 plus. And each try, which it took me 3 tries to cross the Sonora Desert, we suffered a lot. You know, the first time we were apprehended by Border Patrol, and I spent two nights or one night because I blacked my incarceration up. I blacked it out. And so I spent either 48 hours in detention. And, you know, we hear about the effects of detention. I spent less than 3 days in there, and I still suffer PTSD from those few hours that I was there. And that was only my first try across the desert. The second time, we ran out of water, and we ironically were rescued by a Border Patrol agent after we needed to get water from a ranch. And we were released back into Mexico. And finally, the third time, we finally made it.
You know, you're bringing me back to a conversation we had during the pandemic with the family of Armando Alejo Hernandez, who had come up from Mexico to see his sons in Utah and left them messages and then died in the desert, in the Sonoran Desert. And so what you survived, Javier, is truly astounding. And when you think of how many thousands of people who have died in the Sonoran Desert alone, the artists that we traveled to in the desert who put up crosses for as many people as he could, who he learned about their names, this all being done in the name of U.S. policy of deterrence, your response to that, and also for people to keep in their mind, you were 9 years old.
You know, in my trips as a 9-year-old, And in writing this book, which took me 20 years to even begin to process everything that I witnessed and everything that I've survived, in the process of writing this book, I've realized that there were certainly people that died in each of the crosses that I attempted to get to this country. And it is because of them that I am here. And I just hope that anybody listening, anybody reading, and even the president himself, hopefully, just realizes that we're all just human beings trying to have a chance at a better life. And thank you to all those artists. Thank you to all the writers, anybody who believes that us immigrants are more than our trauma and are more than what we're asking for. We're just human beings. Okay.
And Javier, you convey this so powerfully and poignantly, both in your poetry and in this book, Solito. But let's jump forward to how you do convey this, how you became a writer. But first, tell us how you met your parents, how you saw them in the United States, and then who influenced you, how you came to be a writer through all of this trauma.
You know, I left El Salvador on April 6, 1999, and I finally met my parents on June 11th, 1999. And I opened a door in Tucson, Arizona, which ironically is my home now. And I see two shadows. And I recognize my mom because she left me when I was 5 years old. And then I see this man behind her. And I knew how my father looked, or what my father looked like, from pictures. But pictures and reality are two different things. And so he was a stranger. And I think that's a metaphor for how I felt after not being around him for 8 years. And it took us a few, months until I got comfortable with not only my dad, but with my mom being in this country. And I had to live with the fact that, you know, we were all undocumented. From 1999 until I'm 21 years old, I don't have papers and I can't return to my homeland. And I think that fact is a huge reason why I became a writer. And it was in high school that when Google becomes Google, that I Google Salvadoran writers. And the first name that comes up was Roque Dalton, who is a leftist writer who wanted to create a better El Salvador. And I start reading his work. And what really impacted me was that Roque Dalton spoke like us and he wrote like us, meaning the rural Salvadorans, not the elite Salvadorans who wanted to replicate Spain, Spanish, but he wrote like the people. And I hope that in both my poetry and my prose, I am in tune with our caliche, which is Salvadoran slang. And that's all I wanted when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, and I was searching for Salvadoran books. And I hope that my book now could speak to another 9-year-old Salvadoran, Guatemalan, Honduran kid who has immigrated or is thinking of immigrating to this country.
Well, Javier Zamora, we thank you so much for spending this time with us. Salvadoran poet and writer, author of the best-selling memoir Solito, also unaccompanied, a collection of poems about his experience migrating to the United States as a 9-year-old child to reunite with his parents. Javier has been a Stegner Fellow at Stanford and a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard and holds fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation as well. We're going to interview him in Spanish after the broadcast, and we're going to post it on our Spanish website. You can go to democracynow.org and click right through. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanjit Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
RCT in sound from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Grant, do you remember a movie from the 1980s called The Dresser? It starred Albert Finney as a Shakespearean actor and Tom Courtney as his dresser, that is the guy who helps him get ready to go on stage each night. Does that ring a bell?
Vaguely, Albert Finney, he's great, so maybe it's something I saw.
Yeah. I have a vague memory of that movie being kind of heavy. These days, you'll also see The Dresser performed as a play. And recently, a New Mexico paper published a story about a local run of that play. But it seems that the headline writer hadn't really paid attention to the plot, because the headline originally read, "The Dresser centers on relationship between actor and furniture."
Oh, no. It's not furniture. It's someone who helps someone else dress to put on clothes.
Yes, as we always say on the show, words can have more than one meaning.
Yes. The life of a reporter.
Yes, you live in mortal dread of making a mistake like that and having to correct it for everybody to see. Of course, the good thing about making mistakes online is that this was quickly corrected to "play centers on the relationship between an aging actor and his dresser." But the bad thing about publishing stories online is that people can still dig them up and take screenshots.
Absolutely. Reporters, everyone sees your work. They see your errors. Of course, that's true for radio hosts as well, as you and I both know.
Our listeners will let us know if we goof, that's for sure.
Yeah, or if we put out if we put out a newsletter with a typo in it and it goes out to tens of thousands of people, boy, will they reply. Thank you for letting us know. We always do appreciate it. You know, and you make gaffes too, and sometimes they're hilarious. And if you can laugh at yourself, well, let us laugh too. Send your gaffes to words@waywardradio.org or call us on the phone, 877-929-9673. That's toll free 24 hours a day in the United States and Canada. And there are lots of ways to reach us on social media at waywardradio.org/contact.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Magali, and I am calling from Fairbanks, Alaska.
Hello, Margali, Fairbanks, Alaska, one of my new favorite places.
Well, so I have something that I've been meaning to ask you for a while. This is an expression that my husband, as an endearing term, has been calling me for the last 20 years, like whippersnapper. I might not say it very well, but whippersnapper. So I'm wondering, where does it come from and what does it mean exactly? If you could enlighten me, that would be great.
And what kind of context would he use this term in?
Oh, just when he's, I think, like, you know, affectionately, just, you know, in instead of calling me sweetie or you know, like when we are just talking about different things, in that kind of context.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, that's got an interesting history to it. It goes back to, there was a fad in the 17th century in England where young men would race horses. And this is typically, as you might expect, the kind of thing that young men would do. Anytime there's something to be raced, young men will do it. And
of course,
they would crack whips to make the horses go faster. Not necessarily crack the whips on the horses, but you know, the whips go so fast they make the loud snapping sound as they pass the speed of sound. They make a pop, a huge pop. And there was a fad for those with money, lots of money, to spend it on teams of faster horses and expensive coaches and to race them all at high speeds. And they would perfect their whipping technique to know just how to whip it and to touch the animal with it to get it to move without disturbing the ones next to it. So sometimes